right. I'm sitting right here. You can't ask that. Maybe you can write a note or wait until I leave. And I said, and the bishop said, and the DS was there. They said, no, this is it. And I said, well, I guess we'll take her. And I started my ministry there. I had not realized that this was an injured church. Do you know churches can be injured? Do you know churches can be broken? Do you know churches can be places you don't want to go? Do you know that churches can be very difficult places? I got there, I could not believe they had not paid their apportionment for the last 4 years. I could not believe they had $200,000 deficit on their budget. I could not believe that in the last year they had lost 700 members. They had moved from being 800 in the pews to being 60 in the pews. I could not believe that the bishop had not told me these things. And I could not believe that in spite of all their deficits and in spite of their decline, I could not believe they were actually planning on building a building. I'm like, where are you going to get the money from? You have a deficit. I said, no, I don't know much about accounts or economy or any of that. But you know what? I do know my numbers. If you have a deficit, you really shouldn't be building a new sanctuary. Just me talking here. I could not believe this. One of the leaders came and said to me, are you a hospice pastor? I said, what's a hospice pastor? He said, that's a pastor who comes to help churches die with dignity. I got on my knees and I started trying to call back to my little Nina church. And they said, sorry, we already have a pastor here. Well, I'm stuck. The thirst. I'm thirsty to be loved unconditionally. And I said to that congregation when I got up my first Sunday, you don't have to love me back. I have enough love for all of us. I'm going to love you. Oh, we could tell you miracles of what's been going on at First United Methodist Church, at Community United Methodist Church in Naperville. I could tell you miracles about how that church, it's almost as though, you know, we were a stump and now we're seeing little growths. I could tell you about how we invited someone to do our survey, our feasibility study, to find out whether we could actually build the new sanctuary and the new offices. And that company came and said to us, you could not raise more than $800,000. And our building was going to cost us $3.5 million. They said, you know what, $800,000 is the most you can. And I could tell you miracles how within 2 months we had pledged $2.5 million. I could tell you how, wow, it's not just about how much you have. I could then make the story even bigger and tell you that it's much bigger than how much you have in your pocket that matters. It's how much you have in your heart. I could tell you stories of churches in Kenya where people walk in who have no shoes on, and how they are doing mission. I could tell you that the thirst is not about what you have in your pocket or in your hands, but what you have in your heart. I am thirsty. I am thirsty for vision about how our world can become a loving place. I am thirsty, and I don't want to be numb anymore. I don't want to be numbed by meanness, numbed by one-dimensional narratives, numbed by the kind of religions that say, I'm right, you're wrong, so you shut up and sit down. I want to be in conversation like Jesus. I want to be vulnerable like Jesus. I want to speak what I need like Jesus. Give me a drink. I want to be like Jesus so desperately. There he sits, and here she comes. And she looks at him and says, "How? What a surprise. A man talking to a woman. I want to be a person of surprises." She says, "You're a Jew. I'm a Samaritan. We don't talk. I want to talk to people that my people don't talk to. I want to talk to those people that people like me have never talked to." And she says, "I have something you need. I have a bucket. You don't have a bucket." You know, when I was in Kenya last week, I sat with the members of the congregation, and I said to them at Monica Methodist Church, I sat with them and I said to them, when I go back to my little church there in Naperville, we want to be in mission. And I am so sick and tired of the kind of mission where Africans are always on the recipient end. So tell me, how can my wealthy Naperville American Christians be in missions in Kenya? And it was amazing what the leaders said. They said, ask your American friends, ask our American brothers and sisters to come to Kenya and be with us. Tell them not to bring us anything. Tell them not to come and help us. Tell them not to come and build stuff. Tell them not to come and start more feeding programs. Because that's a narrative that continues to keep Africans appearing in the world stage as poor. We want to be equals in our spirituality as Christians. We want our American Christian brothers and sisters to do something different, which is to say, we will come and be with you, pray with you, sing with you. We will come and be in relationship with you, have Bible study with you, call you brother and sister. I said, they can't do that. They're not able to do that. They said, tell them to just come and be with us. Do you know how difficult it is to be with someone? It's easier to do for people. It's easier to go to Detroit and do something. Well, be. Go and be. In Chicago, oh, you should see as we make our way to our son's school. You should see the neighborhoods. They could break your heart in 1,000 pieces that in the wealthiest part of the world. Oh, you don't need to cross the ocean to see such despair. To see people who could be walking around with an American passport, the most difficult thing to get in the world, with American citizenship, American citizens in Chicago, walking around 7 o'clock in the morning and somebody's already so drunk or so high on something. 25, 23, 20-year-old dead-end lives. I'm talking about Chicago. Be. And sometimes it's so difficult to see that I try to numb myself by avoiding and staying on the interstate. Oh, God is thirsty. Jesus is thirsty. for relationship, our relationship together. I am thirsty. And there are so many reasons. You're a man, I'm a woman. You are Jew, I'm Samaritan. I have a bucket, you don't. I am thirsty. And then the conversation begins. This incredible relationship that they begin to talk, and they talk a conversation that is not afraid of the history, their history together, their history of Jacob's well. They must have talked their history of Exodus and their history of the promised land, the history of exile. They must have talked, and Jesus must have said, I too don't feel at home anywhere. They must have talked until they talked into the personal. They got so vulnerable. They got so vulnerable. I want a place where there is this kind of conversation. That I pastor a church where at the door it says, be prepared to be vulnerable. Where at the door it says, you are safe here to be vulnerable. They have such a conversation. In heaven, Jesus must have said, of all the conversations I had that was so sweet, it felt like a cold drink of water was sitting by that well, talking to that vulnerable woman with a heartbreak. I'm talking to a place where she started experiencing the healing that comes. She left her water jar and ran to her village. And she spoke her story. She had the courage to speak her story, to be vulnerable, to be wholehearted about her story. And when they heard her story, no, they did not make a monument for her. No, she did not start a new church, a mega church in Samaria. No, they did not make her a saint. Instead, they came for themselves. She did not stand in their way and say, now I will be the head honcho in Samaria. I'm the one who knows Jesus. So you want to know Jesus, you talk to me. No, she got out of the way. And they went and invited Jesus to stay with them. It says for 2 days she stayed with them. You know how it said that Jews and Samaritans do not share the same utensils? Well, Jesus was eating with them for 2 days. He must have shared their utensils with them, their food with them. Suddenly, there is a break of all the cultural and traditions they knew. This Jesus who's able to break those barriers that we've known all our lives. I don't know where the world is going, but I know this, that we as disciples of Jesus Christ are called to keep our eyes on Jesus, are called to find a third way, are called to be fearless about our past. And I know that it's an everyday struggle. My final story is sitting there in Naperville, driving through just after one of those terrible crises, race crisis. And I see the blue and light behind me, and I draw on the side. It's about 10 o'clock at night. I'm coming from church. And I, who have been a police chaplain, do you know I panicked? Do you know the stories that I had been listening to suddenly took over? Do you know that I was so terrified, I was wishing I could pull off all the melanin in my face and in my hair. I wished I could be anything but me. I wished I could be my white husband or that he had been there with me. I was so ashamed and terrified of who I suddenly had been taught that I was, a black woman. I had never in my life thought of myself that way. I was so terrified that I did what every family teaches their black kid to do. We taught our son, when you're stopped, you keep your hands on the steering wheel. And you say yes, sir, and no, sir, whether you're right or wrong. I was so terrified that I threw up. I threw up. I was so scared. I'm a senior pastor in Naperville, for crying out loud. The officer came up. He said, your tail light is down. And I said, sir, I did not realize that. He said, are you okay? I said, I'm okay, sir. He said, license, registration? Yes, sir. It's in my glove compartment. I'm going to lean over. Leaned over, I gave it to him. He said, oh, Pastor Grace. Oh, yes. I didn't know it was you. Yes, it is. Well, good to see you. Are you okay? Yes. Are you okay? Yes, I am. Can I help you? I'm okay. For a minute, I started listening to a different story. I drove home, shaking like a leaf. Took a shower. Remembered the story that I bought into, the Jesus story. And the next day, I went to the police station. And I thanked them for the work they do. And during the Dallas crisis, wrote a letter to our Naperville police to say, I'm your pastor. Just to remind you, I'm your pastor. This Jesus story that walks the thin line, Samaria, and Judea. This Jesus story that remembers both the little green frog as well as the heron are my brothers. This Jesus story that continues to just weave a new reality. This Jesus story that refuses to be numb. This Jesus story that refuses to be numb, that continues to be vulnerable. This Jesus story that leads us even into saying that even in the 21st century, when the world is falling apart, it seems, God is still at work. Thanks be to God for this Samaritan woman. We don't know her name. This she who gave Jesus something which was more than just water, but hospitality even into her own home. May that be true for you and for me. Thanks be to God. Amen. Thank you. I don't know if we have time for two questions or responses. I would love that if you have any responses.
I think we should leave it up to the grace of the congregation, so to speak. Typically, we end at about 11, but anybody can leave if he wants to.
Yes.
But, you know, it's some of us are going to stay, I'm sure. So how is that?
Thank you. Yes, please. You are welcome. I know people have schedules, so please don't feel that you do need to stay. I know we are all politely kind, but I would be quite okay if you needed to go to the next thing you need to go to. And then two, three maybe responses or questions or conversation places.
Okay. Well, just that we've all heard that story so many times, and with such a different take on it usually, and this was so refreshing and so mind expanding and so marvelous. Mm-hmm. And I think all of us have been very blessed by your presence here.
Thank you.
And especially that very beautiful story that I often think about. That, you know, I don't know if you remember Arthur Ashe, but he was asked by a reporter how awful it must be to have AIDS. And he said, not as hard as it's been to look in the mirror and know that I'm black. And it always just touched me so. Mm-hmm. And your story reminded me of that.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
Grace, I have a very dear rabbi friend who was also a chaplain in the Navy. And he has talked to me recently. He's in Georgia. And he is not a Messianic Jew. He's a Jew through and through. But he's very, very, he's always been very motivated to promote the relationship between Christians and Jews. And he is currently writing a commentary on the Gospel according to Matthew. And the reason that he is doing this is because he believes, particularly in that Gospel, that there may be historical ways that the early Christians in particular, and medieval Christians especially, looked at Matthew, which somehow justified their animosity towards Jews as the people who crucified Jesus. And you weren't talking about Christians and Jews, but clearly it applies mm-hmm. to any group mm-hmm. of peoples. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that it is an interesting commentary on what you're saying. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I had started working on my PhD in New Testament studies at Vanderbilt University under the direction of Amy J. Levine, who is one of the leading New Testament scholars. She is Jewish herself, and she is, I don't know if you've heard of her, she's an amazing, does a similar thing, where, and one of the reasons that I actually abandoned my work, I had done as far as working on the dissertation and had defended the first writing, and gone to live with the Samaritans in Israel for 3 weeks. And they are now a very small group. There are between 500 to 800 Samaritans, and they are so conservative that they have not married outside Samaritanism, and they're so strict and clear about keeping the law. And I had wondered whether Samaritans are metaphors or whether they're actually real people. So that's why I had gone to live with them and to find out more about them. But my downfall in my work, and why I abandoned my dissertation and a moment of being vulnerable, actually is saying that I actually couldn't. I had to go through counseling for 2 years. I just couldn't take it. And the reason I couldn't take it seems so simple now after about 12 years when I look back. And what had happened was I had been unable to actually reconcile that it's possible that God has called more than one people to be the chosen people. Because the Samaritans were so clear that they were the chosen people. And then and then in living there, discovering that the Jewish people did not think of Christians as Jews. And I had always thought we were Jewish. And then I said, no, you're different. You're Gentiles. Well, I couldn't do this. And I had been brought up in my own theological tradition. My tradition that I grew up in Kenya with was there's only one way, the Jesus way. And you're either in or out. And I couldn't reconcile that it was God's house was bigger than just one. It had to be just one. I could not reconcile that God was bigger than just this one thing. Because I couldn't understand how then my grandfather had given up his religious tradition. I mean, we had given up everything African to become Christians because it was the only way. We had given up our names, our tradition. We have so little left. Now you're telling me that we didn't have to do that? That Jesus actually comes to Samaria, to Africa, and makes African Christians, that we don't have to first be European? What? What a waste. That there's a difference between Christianity and colonialism? That the two are not the same thing? I could not deal with that. I could not do that. And so my own work, thanks to Amy J. Levine, this Jewish New Testament professor who began to help me work with how to be a Christian without being anti-Semitic. And then moving on, how to be a Christian without being anti-African or anti-white or anti- this thin line I'm talking about. And how to constantly be in conversation. And how to constantly be around truth tellers who can perhaps challenge me when I fall in ways that are sexist or homophobic or xenophobic. And how to dare trust a God who's bigger than me. Whoa, now that's something. How to trust a God who's bigger than me? That God is bigger. But how to make sure I don't numb myself when I get hurt or injured, whether by my culture, my church? How to be open to being vulnerable. So this conversation with our Jewish brothers and sisters, and thank you for prompting me on that. There's that story of the rabbi who makes that comment when the children of Israel are crossing the Red Sea, and then suddenly the waters come back and the Egyptians are drowned. And how that commentator says, the Jewish commentator says, when the angels look up and they're dancing and they say to God, we did it, the enemies have died. And they look up and God has a tear in God's face. And God says, my children have just died. That the Egyptians are also God's children. So walking that amazing, and one can only do it through being vulnerable and being in conversation. At least for me, that's the medicine I have come to take on that. So this Samaritan story and this Jesus who tells amazing stories about the Samaritan, the Good Samaritan, that must have offended Jesus's people. The Samaritan who came back to say thank you and the nine didn't come back, wow! People must have been so mad. Somebody must have thrown down their sandals and walked out and said, I don't want to hear that. You know, this constantly trying to tell us good stories about the people who have hurt us most. You know, looking for the good stories of, so that we don't demonize others or dehumanize them. The good stories as well. So yeah. I don't know if that, thank you for prompting me. I went way over as always, but that's just me. I do that kind of thing. Would you want more? Yes, go ahead.
When I saw the picture this week of the little 5-year-old Syrian boy who was, it was just heartbreaking picture, and he's been in the bombing, and he's sitting there stunned, and I'm here looking at a lake, and I'm really comfortable. And my husband, I don't know where the term comes from, but it's called cognitive dissonance, where this fine line that we're on, where we know in our hearts, what's happened right there, that's wrong. Mm-hmm.
And the tears are part of the prayer, that we know about it is part of the prayer, that our hearts are broken is part of the prayers, that we continue to know why that happened and we refuse to be pacified and to forget, because we have to be determined to know why it got where it did. The letter that seems to be such a small drop in the ocean that has to be written, the questions and the courage to ask about it, and that we have mentioned him and his family today. Because part of the fear is not to say anything, and part of the fear is to make us believe that we are powerless, that, you know, what can I do? Well, a lot. And it doesn't mean you're going to fix it. Doesn't mean I'm going to fix it. But we refuse to live in fear. I said to my son when we got ready to travel, we had booked our tickets to go through Istanbul, then the chaos happened, and we had to redo our tickets. And he said, Mom, I'm so scared of flying anymore. I said, well, no. You know what? You're not guaranteed anything. None of us is. But we refuse to not travel. We refuse. Yeah, sure, that could happen, but we refuse. There's so many of us that we refuse to be stuck and to be, you know, we refuse. So, you know, part of that that he's been mentioned this morning, even in a place like this. Thanks be to God. Amen. Thank you. Thank you very much. Blessings. Yeah.